Hey, and welcome to another episode of The Disciplined Investor. This is your host, Andrew Horowitz, and I am pretty excited about today because not only today, actually coming up, we have some great things. We have some wonderful guests lined up, And let me tell you quickly what we're going to be talking about today so you get an idea, and then we're going to step right into it. We're going to go over the markets, emotions, and leverage. Oh my. Talk about what's happening right now in these markets, because right now I have a feeling there's a lot of people that are getting a little bit antsy and rather squashed as it is when it comes to their investments. I have an interview with Richard Bookstaber. He is the best-selling author of a book entitled A Demon of Our Own Design, and it is all about hedge funds, the markets, leverage, etc. So that is a very timely matter. And I also am going to tell you how to and figure out the winners from the weekly contest that we are calling Do You Want To and Are You the Next Peter Lynch? You have some great stock ideas, and we're going to give you a place to actually record those and then be voted on by your peers. And what will happen is we're giving away prizes. I'll tell you all about that. Also, telling you about the fine gentleman from OneWeekJob.com, Sean Akins, coming to work for me next week. And also, coming to a Zune marketplace by you, The Disciplined Investor is actually going to be one of the premier podcasts on the Zune marketplace, and a special offer on 100 copies of the book, The Disciplined Investor. And that's all coming up here on The Disciplined Investor Podcast. Sit down, get strapped in, get your pen and paper out, because I'm telling you, today is going to be rocking. This is The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, welcome to episode 33 of The Disciplined Investor Podcast. Again, this is Andrew Horowitz, your host. And thanks for joining me. Let's start right off with something easy, and then we're going to get into something that's, I think, going to probably piss you off pretty good because it's pissing me off. And it's all about executive pay and who's making money. But let's hold off on that for a second because, as I say, don't get me started. Number one in the lineup today I want to talk to you about is the contest we're having, the Do You and Can You and Are You the Next Peter Lynch? Peter Lynch was a great guy. He was a money manager for many years, and he was in charge of the Fidelity Magellan Fund, well known by investors. And one of the things that he did was he really kind of observed what people were doing. He watched buyers and investors and people and products and, you know, the trends. And what he did was he watched them and watched for people and what they were doing. And then what he would do is research what stocks were behind them, and he started buying them. I'll give you an example of something like that, right? We started to see a real change in the drinking habits of individuals. They were moving away from the carbonated beverages for a while and into the softer beverages such as waters and bottled waters. And we saw Gatorade, and we saw these things kind of like called Propel and a variety of other flavored waters. And I did some research. I wanted to find out, because I really like the Propels. I drink them all the time. I have one right here, as a matter of fact. Keep my whistle wet during these podcasts. I drink peach. I drink the berry. I like the kiwi strawberry. And I looked and I searched. Who's making the Propel? Well, if you look down, you'll find out it's Gatorade. Gatorade, division of Pepsi. We looked at it very carefully and saw that there was a new transition, a new paradigm when it came to soft drinks, and decided that we would pick Pepsi up. Well, right now we're about 15 points up on it, and much of the newest earnings that have been showing the most growth with the company, if you look at any of their 10Ks and 10Qs and look at any of the earnings reports and the news items, it's all from their alternative beverage lines, such as Propel and Gatorade. And that's just one of the ways in which Peter Lynch really did the investigation. He kind of found out what people liked, what they were doing, and acted on it. So I'm asking you, are you the next Peter Lynch? And each week we're giving away a $50 gift certificate as well as a copy of my book. And in the end, we're going to take a list of all the winners, and you can vote on them. Go to the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and vote on it. And basically, all you have to do is this. You have to make a telephone call. You have to pitch the stock. Not to say, oh, my stock is this, but tell me why it is. And we'll replay it on the site. Here's the number. It's toll free. 877-623-8473. 877-623-8473. And you dial that number and you just, for 1 minute, pitch whatever stock it is, why it is. And when we play it on the site, people vote on it. We have week one and two winners up on the site right now. And if you are one of the winners, you'll claim your prize and we'll send out the gift certificates as well as the book for you, The Disciplined Investor. Second item, OneWeekJob.com. You got to check this out. I was in Boston last week at a conference, and sometimes things happen for strange reasons. I was watching the Sunday morning CNN news, and I noticed something very interesting. There was a gentleman on there. His name is Sean Aiken, and he is a recent college graduate looking for work. The question was, what was it that he would do? Well, he didn't know. He asked his father, "What should I do?" And his father said something like, "You know, whatever you do, Sean, you know, love what you do and be the best at it, and you're going to enjoy it." So he set out to find out, well, maybe there's something out there for me. I'm going to try some things out. But he didn't do it like your ordinary kid would, by maybe trying out a job and seeing how he liked it, and if he didn't like it, move on. He deliberately is trying out one new job every single week. Pretty cool. I mean, he's all over the country. He's done some amazing things. The website is OneWeekJob.com. Now, why do I tell you about this? Why do I bring this up? Because you know what he's going to be this week? Yep. He is going to be an investment advisor, a stockbroker, a money manager, a podcast host. He's going to be kind of working with me for the next week. And I thought it was really cool and something that he would really enjoy and I would enjoy doing for him. Because especially what I found especially great was that his profits and the money that he is earning from all the things he's doing is going to charity. That's what it's all about, doing something like that. He's learning a lot. He's touching lives. And amazingly, he's is really going to, I think, do something fantastic moving forward. So that's pretty cool. Next, I thought I'd share with you a bit of a rant. I want to tell you something that has really been aggravating me. You know, this week we saw an amazing movement in the stock markets. The Fed spoke and dropped interest rates down 25 basis points on two different accounts. And you know, concerns were continuing to boil to the surface about the mortgage market and the subprime mess and the economy. And I want to know, how are you doing in these markets? I ask that because I have a feeling you're not doing so well. Now, I'll tell you why. Because I get emails all the time. I see clients that tell me about how their friends are doing. And one of the biggest problems is that you're never going to do well in these markets. Wait, let's back up. Andrew, what do you mean you're never going to do well in these markets? You are not going to do well in these markets if you stay and play by the rules. Why is that? The truth is that the man, and who's the man? Wall Street has taught you things. They've explained to you that you need to invest this way and you need to invest that way. You need to buy and hold. You need to buy on the lows and sell on the highs. And, you know, you need to be careful in what you do and you need to buy mutual funds and hold on. And, oh, come on. You know why they say all this? They say this because they want to make sure that the markets are solid. They want to make sure that you know, you're the ones holding the bottom of the markets, because if you were trading in and out, what's going to happen? There's going to be excess volatility in the market, and that is not going to be good to them. You know, if they preach trading, markets would be wild. They talk about leverage. Never use margin in your accounts. Wait a second. Never use margin in your accounts, they say. But at the same time, they're going out 10, 15, 20 times margining accounts, leveraging them up to a point that causes excess volatility in the markets, as we saw in July and August. But they're telling you not to do it. They're telling you not to trade. They're telling you all these things that you should be doing, but at the same time, what's happening? In the back, they're doing it right under your nose. How come nobody's ever told you this before? They are preying on your emotions. They tell you don't day trade, you know? But you know what happens? They find you emotionally messed up because the market's moving, and they slam it even harder so they can force your hand, force you to sell, and then pick it up on the dips. That's what they're doing. How do I know this? That's what I do every day. We know this. We watch this. We see what's going on. The bread and butter of the hedge funds is multiple leverage, but they tell you not to again. Wow. You know what else aggravates me right now? We are seeing companies such as Citigroup, such as Merrill Lynch, find an incredible amount of losses. I mean, losses that are historic. And yet, the CEO is still making a ton of money. Recently, the departing CEO of Merrill Lynch, Mr. O'Neill, the second highest paid Wall Street CEO in 2006, is retiring. Ah, great. Why? Because right upon this time when he was retiring and their recent earnings came up, by the way, there was a little bit of a loss. A little bit of a loss. How about the largest ever quarterly loss ever for Merrill Lynch? $2.24 billion. dollar loss precipitated by a $7.9 billion third quarter write-down because they were revaluing the assets by shaky mortgages and all their leverage problems, etc. But he's leaving with over $130 million of an equity package of stocks, options, restricted shares, and restricted units. I mean, come on. And now we hear in the background that the CEO of Citigroup is going to maybe do the same, leave with a big fat package and leave what? Leave you holding the bag. I mean, come on, folks. Let's wake up here because, you know, they're telling you a lot of this stuff to make sure that they're taken care of. They have the power. They have the microphone. They have the platform. They have the bullhorn to say, you know what? Don't do this. Don't do that. This is the way you do. We've been trained. We've been trained like puppy dogs to listen to the rhetoric that they give us about investing, throw it in the garbage. That's the whole point that why I put this book together. Not that I'm, you know, going over this again, but you know what? They're telling you untruths. They're telling you things only to make sure that they're taken care of. Don't buy into it. Right now, exactly right now, this is what you should be doing. You should have cash on the sidelines. How much? Well, maybe about 25 to 40%. I've been telling you for the last 3 or 4 weeks now that you need to start taking profits. And you need to start doing what they do. You need to be looking for careful, surgical buys on major dips. Let's take a look at some things that happened recently, right? We see your earnings coming out. We have a big earnings season that is happening right now, and it's right in front of us. Crocs. Dipping $30, $30 per share. Fine, I told you this was going to happen eventually, and it's happening right now, and right on schedule, right after the summer summertime came out, their earnings came down very, very dramatically, and their future earnings are not as bright as they thought, but we bought them on the dip. Wait a minute, Andrew, you're buying on the dip Crocs? Yeah, I'm buying on the dip. I'm looking to make some money. I don't care what the name is. I don't care what's happening. But if you look at Crocs, you look at it as a growth story, the fact of the matter is that Crocs shouldn't have gotten hit as hard as it did. We picked up a block of it for our clients at the lowest points on Thursday and Friday. Look at other companies, not that we own these or not that I'm recommending these, but Las Vegas Sands, Wynn Resorts. I mean, we saw a dip in their earnings because of some acquisition work, as well as the fact that there was a little bit of softness in the gambling space, along with a company like ShuffleMaster. And these are great companies to take a look at because these are the companies that you want to buy on the dips. Garmin, Sears. I mean, these are companies that you can kind of start looking at once you see all the overhead start to dissipate and the bottoms fall out. This is what would happen if you were a professional money manager. So if you're not going to do this, why even bother doing any investing at all? And why even bother listening to anybody talking about investments? You have to listen with a very, very fine-tuned ear and listen to what is going to benefit you, only you. That's not selfish. That's just smart investing. Because the party line that's being discussed is usually developed by the guy who's looking to make some money for himself. He is making sure that what he says on television is probably beneficial to him. We need to be smart and ahead of the game and ahead of them. So once again, what should you be doing right now? Well, you should be sticking with some favorites, some things I've been talking about, like the Gateway Fund, which is a market neutral fund that if you look at it, it hasn't been hit very hard lately. You should be shorting things and maybe moving into mutual funds like the Prudent Bear Fund, maybe the Pro Fund Ultra Short, because these are the times that the markets are going to get very rocky. I've been getting a ton of emails. What to do? What do I do, Andrew? What's going to be happening with the markets? Listen, this is very clear. I'm going to say it very clearly to you. The markets have huge problems moving ahead of them. We have an overhead of selling that's about to happen again like we saw in August. And I say this because if you understand the leverage, if you understand the hedge market funds, and you understand the markets of what's going on right now, and you add to that the Fed speak of late, there is really some concern out there. If you don't want to be trampled, think about utilizing some smarts. Number one, cash. Number two, you want to be in some of these market neutral funds. And number three, stick to your disciplines. Next week, Jim Joubak from Microsoft is going to be on, and we're going to be talking about, we're trying to work on a show about how, when, why do I sell? What kind of sell disciplines do I have? We all know how to buy. Not many of us really know how to sell. I mean, I got to tell you something, even as an investment advisor doing this for over 20 years, it is a discipline that you need to hone continually. When am I going to sell? Do I just do something like a Bill O'Neill from Investor's Business Daily and say, 7% losses, cut it, move on? Or Do I do something a little bit different? Do I say I'm going to use a trailing stop? I'm going to use maybe protective puts. I'm going to say I'm going to take out my profits first and let the rest ride. I mean, whatever it is, you need to develop a discipline. We develop it every single day for our clients because it's so, so important. Finally, here's something else. This is the time to start sticking with old favorites. Things like the Dogs of the Dow, the 10 highest yielders. I'm going to put a link to that on the site because I think it's something you need to see. The Dogs of the Dow is a great place to be looking right now, and especially because the end of the year and the turnaround for the year is coming up. As a matter of fact, I dedicate an entire chapter of my book, Chapter 2, on quantitative investing, and that's really because it is so important in this kind of market. And especially right now, watch for earnings. We're in the heart of earnings season, and we are going to be trampled with just a ton of earnings coming out in the next couple of weeks. So be very, very careful out there, folks. Don't sit on your hands. Be smart. Think ahead of the pros. You can do it. I know you can. When we get back, we're going to be depressed a little bit more because I think that my next guest, Richard Bookstaber, is going to be very helpful to explain some of the issues that are kind of confronting us right now when it comes to the markets. And like I told you before, what I really want to go into is what I really want you to know is that next week you need to stay tuned for this. It's going to be great. Jim Jubak, just an amazing, amazing writer for Microsoft's Money Central site, is going to be with us, and we're going to share some good ideas and some practical knowledge on how exactly you can set up these particular sell disciplines. So, I think the final thing I want to mention to you was also, this is the last week, folks. You want to pick up my book, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, before the official release of the second edition. You know, we sold out of the first. This one we're not going to sell out of, but the price has been raised. There's some more pages in it. There's a bunch of great stuff that has been added. But if you want this is the last time for the $14.95 price. You can go to the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click the store, and you'll get a $5 reduction right now. And I'm going to sign 100. Only 100 is the last signing I'm going to do virtually for this right now. Is the first 100 or last 100 or the only 100 books that are bought right now, I'm going to personally sign to you, and we'll send out as soon as they are here. The new date is November 15th. We're having a book signing party and all sorts of great things happening and a lot of press happening and all sorts of cool stuff. So we had that soft release first. This is the official release. This will be, I think, it's something you really like. So if you want that book, $14.95 from now to November 15th, and only 100 will get a signed copy. So do yourself a favor, get that. I think you'll really enjoy it. You'll learn a lot. When we get back, Richard Bookstaber coming up, Demon of Our Own Design on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
Looking for answers to today's complex financial markets? Then be sure to get your copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, your all-in-one guide to investing. Order now at thedisciplinedinvestor.com or your favorite bookstore. The Disciplined Investor. Together, we will reach success.
All right. So as promised, we are here with Richard Bookstaber. He is the writer, the author of a really cool book. It's called A Demon of Our Own Design. And we're going to talk about risk management issues. We're going to talk about the markets. Now, you know, I read parts of the book and I read on your blog. You have a lot of great information there. And what I'm curious about is tell us what the genesis of this book was.
Okay. The main reason I was interested in writing this book is that in my time working in risk management, I noticed that even though economic risk seemed to be dropping, and it should be dropping over time, you know, GDP, variability of GDP is reducing over time. We have recessions that are less frequent and more shallow, partly because the central banks and the Fed have gotten their act together, and partly because the economy is broader and more diversified. But in spite of that, we look at the financial markets and we see a market that tends to be more and more crisis prone. So the question that I wanted to answer is, why is it when the economy is becoming less risky over time, the markets themselves actually seem to be getting more risky?
And more risky, we're really talking about the not only risk, but the volatility and the range of the returns and everything going on there, right?
Right. Yeah, in a lot of measures, the markets seem to be more risky. But the real focus for me in the book are the crises that tend to occur: the crash in '87, the LTCM crisis 11 years after that, And now, we have the subprime mess today.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that really I found interesting was that you recently testified on this in front of a House Financial Services Committee, right?
Right.
And
about 3 weeks ago.
What are they really trying to dig up? What are they trying to figure out? I mean, if you could tell us that.
Well, in my testimony, and of course, all of this is, public. You can go and if you know how to work through the governmental websites, you can pull up the testimony and see it. I was there for a session specifically on trying to understand the role of financial markets in creating systemic risk. That is, what's the possibility that crises that occur in the financial markets could pierce through into the actual economy and cause problems for the overall economy?
Right. And it has. I mean, the whole situation we're dealing with right now is, I mean, it's almost daily. Either they're using it as an excuse right now to say there's more subprime and mortgage concern and housing issues, or the fact is that I think my opinion is that we haven't seen the end of this yet. And now, so let's get back to the first thing that you mentioned there. You said that the question was, why is it that it seems that there's more reaction and there's more of these crises that happen and that has been happening in the financial markets? Is one of the things that you discovered the whole additional use of leverage that has had a multiplier effect on financial instruments?
Yes. One of the key causes, I really point to two characteristics in the market that seem to be the reason the markets are more and more crisis prone. And one of them is leverage. And the reason for that is that when there's a market shock, if hedge funds or others are very highly levered, they get into a mode of forced liquidation. You know, they have to liquidate because their creditors, whether they have margin or, haircuts on collateral, are saying, hey, you know that $900 million that we lent you? Well, the collateral on that now is only worth $800 million, so you have to start selling. And then they start to sell, and that very selling drops prices even more, so the banks go back to them and say, wait a minute, that $800 million is now $700 million, you've got to keep on selling. So the leverage creates this liquidity crisis cycle. The other characteristic that I go through in my book that we also, see today with what's going on with subprime is complexity.
Yeah.
And in the financial markets, when you talk about complexity, what you really are talking about are derivatives and structured products and other innovative securities.
Well, the derivative issue was obviously the cause of, several different meltdowns. And I always find it very interesting that it seems that in the end, after the dust settles and we find out all the things that were involved in any kind of crisis, and we look at the derivatives, everybody seems to say, well, nobody really understood it, but they did it anyway. I mean, how does someone with millions and billions of dollars enter into a transaction, such as many of these very complex and convoluted and very, I guess many of the derivatives have relationships with other derivatives that have relationships with other derivatives, and then they're levered even more. How does somebody enter into something like that in good conscience?
Well, the thing with derivatives is that sometimes they're useful. Sometimes there's a good justification because they help people mold returns to better meet their investment objectives.
Right.
But they have another side also, because sometimes they're used to allow people to basically take on exposures that they normally wouldn't be able to take on. For example, you might be an insurance company and you want to have mortgage exposure, but you can't trade in mortgages. So you end up with different swaps that look and feel like a mortgage, but they're off balance sheet. Or somebody wants to take leverage and can't do it directly, so they can have a derivative to do it. Or even something as simple as if you're a U.S. investor and you want to trade stocks in the U.K., there's a very high tax, transaction tax, on trading stocks in the U.K., so you end up instead doing a swap transaction, which gives you that exposure without actually taking delivery of the stocks.
Right.
So there's a lot of reasons that people want to use derivatives, some of them more legitimate from an economic standpoint, some of them, trying to get exposures in which they can't do directly. And then you have sort of the push side of it, that for the investment banks and the banks, derivatives are a great money center. When they come up with a new instrument, there's an audience there to buy it, and they can buy and sell it at a spread.
But now, I just had a client who called me, and he said to me that there was a company that was pitching him on this new idea of a municipal bond investment that had approximately a 7-9% rate of return tax free. I said, really? Well, how does that work? He said, well, it's not your traditional situation. And he started to explain to me. And I said, let me talk to the guys that are really pushing this thing. And what it turned out to be was a investment that had municipal bonds in it, but levered and for my audience, levered meaning, in other words, there was a lot of borrowing going on to buy the bonds and paying off a lower margin cost that they figured, buying long-term bonds. There was a bit of an arbitrage between the spreads and doing like an 8, 9, or 10 times leverage in order to get this. And I said, that's great. And I understand on paper that all works, but where are the risks? And he explained to me that, well, there really is a risk if you have an inversion of the yield curve and all these great things. But I said, here's the problem. Long-term capital management, there was no risk when they dreamed it up, right? I mean, there were very little risk. It was all under control, wasn't it? But then it imploded.
Yeah, the problem, anytime you see something that has leverage, you have a big risk for the simple reason that if somebody's levered 10 to 1, I mean, think of what goes on when you have a margin on a futures contract, which is kind of the simplest sort of leverage. When you buy a futures contract, you discover that essentially, a 10% move, say, or a 5% move in the underlying can end up wiping out all of your capital.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is you haven't really bought, say, $1 million of gold. What you've done is you've put down $50,000 to give you control of $1 million of gold, and if gold drops from that million to 950,000, your 50,000 is wiped out. You've basically levered 20 to 1.
Right.
And so anytime you have leverage, this is the situation. A small move in the market can suddenly wipe out your capital, and in the case of, I don't know the specifics of this municipal bond fund, but what would happen is it wouldn't take too much of a drop in the value of the municipal bonds, and you discover that essentially, your total investment's wiped out.
Right, because the multiplier effect not only works on the up, but it also works on the down. Let's bring this down to the average Joe. And the current state of the economy, the current state of the markets right now, I think of it like this. I say, what if I was an alien dropped from space? Now, I was a Martian that happened to be an economist on Mars, okay? And I was told the following. I was told that we have, unemployment about, I think, 4.7% here or there. We have interest rates that are starting to be dropped because we have this issue of these mortgages and the potential for further fallout of the economy because there's a lot of credit issues going on right now. We have a dollar that's historically low. And again, I could add to some of these other issues. And I would say, that's doesn't sound very good for your stock markets. And yet, at the same time, our stock markets seem to be taking good news as good news and bad news as good news for the most part, on an overall sense. What's happening? Are we waiting for another shoe to drop? Is this really... Are we in this, which I hate to say this, but this new world, a different type of situation, which I don't believe? I mean, what are we missing here? What are the markets missing?
Well, I think one thing that's helping to keep the markets up is there's a lot of sovereign capital, capital from Gulf states, from China and so on, that is coming in. There's also a lot of leverage within the market so that people who normally might, hedge funds, if a hedge fund's levered 4 to 1, then their $1 billion of capital actually, of NAV, actually ends up going into the market as $4 billion.
Exactly.
So you can end up having a lot more money chasing the stocks because the sovereign capital and the levered capital of hedge funds.
But the problem is that if once you start having any kind of an issue where there is a concern over the dollar starts rising, or anything that goes into that equation and the sovereign capital doesn't come in, which we have lots of zeros after the figures of how much sovereign money comes in, right? From a buying of our particular securities to also a buying of our products because it's so cheap right now.
Yeah.
Or what's happening in New York City with the real estate. I mean, what happens there? What happens when that slows down?
Right. Yeah. Well, this is, especially with any sort of levered money or sovereign capital too, for that matter, you know, it's what sometimes is called hot money. Hot money essentially means it's not Warren Buffett type of fundamental value, hold this for the next 5 years type of money. It's searching out where they think the opportunities are, and if problems occur, it's fairly quick to move out of the market. So, yeah, if there is a sense that the market is unstable and there's opportunities that are better someplace else, then I think you could see a lot of this capital move out, you know, with an adverse effect to the market. And to me, the big unknown in all this is the implications of what we're seeing with subprime and how that will feed through to the housing market. Because, you know, the housing market is a pretty big engine for the U.S. Economy, both directly and through, you know, what it does for consumer goods, for consumer cyclicals, and, you know, especially consumer durables.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Listen, what we're going to do is take a quick break, and when I get back, I want to talk to you about quantitative investing and risk management and get your thoughts on that. We're right now talking with Richard Buchstaber, who is the author of A Demon of Our Own Design. You can pick it up, I guess, in bookstores, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. It's a good read. Pick it up. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Did you know that bulls sometimes like the naked option? Bears sometimes buy butterflies. And diamonds are some trader's best friend. And there's nothing so satisfying as when we see our shorts come down. Unless, of course, everyone else has longs and are quickly covering their shorts. Did you ever see hammers with long bodies and short shadows after a shooting star appeared just prior to a dark cloud cover? There have been numerous sightings lately of long collars used upside down, head and shoulders. Sound like gibberish? Well, they're not. These are all real investment terms that you need to know. Learn the lingo and techniques of pro traders before you invest, and you too may even own spiders or even a new convertible. The Disciplined Investor, the groundbreaking book that gives you professional investment tools page after page. The Disciplined Investor. Get your copy and profit from it. Written by Andrew Horowitz.
We're back here with Richard Buchstaber, and I'm going to talk to you about this question of quantitative investing. One of the, I think it's the second chapter of my book it deals with this subject, and I start out with a whole comment of emotions have no part in the world of a quantitative analyst. Okay, and you know, for the average guy out there, you know, how do they use and what can they do, and where's the benefit of quantitative analysis, and what's in your opinion, some ways that they can you know, work on it.
Well, you know, quantitative analysts typically differ from a fundamental analyst in that they can't look at each stock with the level of detail that a fundamental analyst can. You know, they can't understand the ins and outs of management and the subtleties of the supply chain and consumer tastes and how those are shifting. But what they can't get in detail, they try to make up for in volume. So what a quantitative analyst will do is try to understand things not quite as well as a fundamental analyst would for each stock, but then hold many, many stocks and try to average out the things that they don't know. So, for example, if a quantitative analyst's view is that free cash flow over EV is a important measure, and he verifies historically that stocks that have high free cash flow over EV do better than stocks that have poor free cash flow over EV, he'll set up a screen and basically create a portfolio or a strategy where he may be long 200 stocks that have the highest free cash flow over EV and short another 200 stocks that have the lowest.
Right.
And that will be a trade.
Right.
And they'll be carefully balanced to have an equal number of stocks, long and short, sector by sector, and he'll probably be smart enough to know not to do it with financials where that measure doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
So now, you know, a fundamental analyst or, you know, anybody with common sense might look at any one stock he has and say, you've got to be kidding. I can't believe that you're long that stock. Sure, it has a high free cash flow over EV, but do you know A, B, C, and D, you know, all these other things?
Right.
The quantitative analyst will say, look, I know that I'm missing a lot of information, but by having 200 stocks long and 200 stocks short, all of those other things hopefully will average out.
Yeah, one of the...
And I'll
I think that one of the great... Have you ever... you've seen Jim O'Shaughnessy's work, of course, right?
Yeah,
and he wrote a great book back when, a few of them, but What Works on Wall Street, and he just had pages and pages and pages of these types of screens. And, you know, just to kind of make sure everybody knows that, like, the Dogs of the Dow was one of the simplest screens and one of the simplest quantitative style, long only, of course, whereas they, you know, you look for every single year, you look for the highest yielders of the Dow 30, and you pick the top 10, you buy them on January, you do the same thing next January, you sell the ones that are not on the list and buy it all over again.
Right.
Very simple screen, and I think that they could work very nicely. They really can. And you know what I like them for? I think that there's a nice blend if you use quantitative analysis to find things, to kind of uncover things, and then maybe use some fundamental analysis to then further justify what it is that you're trying to do in a stock,
right.
and then use some technical analysis to figure out where the trade is.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for a typical investor or, you know, a fundamental portfolio manager, that's a good approach, because step one, you're filtering out of the universe of many, many stocks the ones that are worth your time and focus. And then you're focusing more to really get to know those well. And then you're looking at the technicals to figure out when to enter that particular trade. If you're quantitatively oriented, you don't do those second two steps. You know, if you're running a pure long-short quant fund. And the problem, you know, as you know, a number of these quant funds had difficulty in early August. Some of them dropped 25-30% in a period of days.
Right.
And the problem, I think, now is that so many people have the data and so many people have computers to do these types of screens, and there's many tools out there that allow you to do it, that these free cash flow over EV types of strategies are pretty commonplace. And so the market's getting really crowded. So the quantitative methods aren't doing as well now as they did, say, 5 years ago.
Yeah, but you look at some of the mutual funds that had these corrections, the ones that were supposed to be market neutral, quote unquote, meaning that we're really not going to see any big drops, even if the markets do really lousy. I mean, some of these really got hurt by 10 to 15% in August. And you got to scratch your head wondering one of two things. Number one, is their entire methodology so far off? Or number two, are they not following their methodology? Isn't that, I think, somewhere in the questioning of all this?
I think what happened with these hedge funds in early August was that they were following their methodology, and they were market neutral. They're very scrupulous in trying to stay neutral to the market and other important systematic factors. But what you had were, between Goldman Sachs Fund, Global Alpha, and a number of other funds like AQR, you had in total tens, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars of capital in similar strategies across all of these funds. And these hedge funds tend to be pretty highly levered, on the order of 5, 6 to 1 or even more. So some market shock, and we still don't know just what that shock might have been, occurred, which forced a couple of these funds to start to liquidate because of this leverage-related liquidity cycle.
Mm-hmm.
As they liquidated, other of the quantitative funds that were in the same strategy saw prices drop in their portfolios because they were holding the same sort of thing. And so they had to start to reduce their positions because of their high leverage. And that pushed prices down even more and led to another reduction. So they got caught in this sort of leverage-based liquidity cycle because they're so highly levered.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So it wasn't really an issue of them not following their strategies. It wasn't an issue of being suddenly, you know, not being market neutral, because the markets actually, nothing was going on with the markets overall during that period.
Right. It was. They were bullied, is what you're saying. They were bullied into doing something they weren't.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah, and because they all had the same strategies on, as they were forced because they're high leverage to sell, the stocks that were underlying those strategies started to drop.
Interesting.
And, you know, to a typical person who didn't have those strategies on, it didn't seem like anything unusual was going on in the market.
Right. Let's finish up on this. Two questions. Number one, the question of the Fed dropping rates initially, pushing a lot of money into the markets, dropping the discount window rate, recently dropping Fed funds. Do you think they're doing the right thing? Is this what is necessary, or they have their back against a wall doing what they are told they need to be doing?
I think the Fed has a fairly limited range of capabilities in this type of a crisis because they can't make people provide credit.
Mm-hmm.
All they can do is basically try to keep rates low to try to stimulate and entice people to provide credit. But, you know, there basically is not a lot the Fed can do if the problem is that people are afraid that, say, the banks are not going to have sufficient capital, or the banks are looking at really large potential write-downs because of uncertainty in how they're marking some of these, CDOs and other securitized instruments. So I think that the Fed's doing what it can, but it can only help so much. And, you know, what's interesting is the normal orientation of the Fed recently has been to have a concern about inflation.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's what concerns me. It seems upside down. Yeah, he's counterintuitive what they're doing and what they're saying.
Right. So they're sort of fighting, you know, the current battle while ignoring the general war. I mean, you look at commodity prices and, oil prices, and you would think that there'd be more concern about inflation, but they can't fight that battle right now because of the, you know, more immediate issues with credit.
Right. I still ask this question, and there's really no answer to this, but it seems on a continual basis that the regulators and the powers that be are behind they're always behind in chasing and putting out fires. This whole mortgage issue, the extraordinary amount of housing activity that took place, they say now, what kind of mortgage do you have? Well, I have an arm and a leg now, because it's so incredible how they've readjusted and done what they've done and really hurt people. It was like right in front of everybody's face, and everybody, whoever you were, really saw it. And I said at one point, it seems to me that it's almost like back in the 20s when there was an unlimited amount of leverage allowed to be used and what caused the stock market crash back then. And people were just buying houses and houses and houses, and there was no oversight.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing to me that, you know, we seem not to learn these sorts of lessons. You look at the LBO activity that was occurring, you know, a lot of private equity activity. That looked a lot like what was going on in 88, 89, and then we had, you know, the junk bond problems. But, you know, we're talking 17, 18 years later, and people just don't have a memory that seems to reach back to events that occurred more than 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
So we have this period of, you know, this boom and, easy credit, low market volatility. So people lever buy houses. And we're not talking just about, by the way, the hedge funds levering. You know, individuals are getting more and more highly levered in the sense of really straining to be able to make payments to get a bigger house with the expectation that that house would appreciate more.
Right.
I completely agree that there's a lack of sort of market maturity or, you know, memory of, you know, the types of things that can go wrong.
Right. It's greed and fear. And I assert this to you, that we're never going to have the memory because we choose not to have that memory because that flies right in the face of our pocket. You know, there's a disconnect between the wallet and the brain. And I think that while, for the most part, many of us, and all of us included in this, that, you know, we see an opportunity, want to grab it, and at the same time, we don't want to have an opportunity get past us. So when everybody's
right.
talking
and
about it,
and we need to see it when somebody else, you know, you always hear the stories, just like you always hear the stories of, you know, the guy at Las Vegas who made $30,000 on some bet. You always hear the story of somebody who bought a house and flipped it and, you know, made $300,000-$400,000 and then bought another house, and now there he is in a $4 million house. So people don't want to be left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And the way these cycles move, the first ones in, you know, do well, and then more and more people go in, and finally, just like what we saw happen with the quant funds, things get so crowded that it sort of implodes on itself.
Yeah. All right, and we'll close on this note, and then you're going to tell us how people can get your book and maybe see you, et cetera. What's your forward look on all the situation? It is a lot more common in the in the area of problems, or have we seen the worst of it?
Well, I'm not a very good person to talk to for prognosticating because, you know, a lot of my background is in risk management. So by nature, I'm sort of a pessimist.
Okay, that's fair enough.
But taking that into account, you know, the big concern I have is with the mortgage market and the impact housing can have on the overall economy.
Yeah.
Which, of course, I'm not the only one concerned about that right now. But the problem with housing that makes it different than a lot of other markets is things happen in housing in a very slow-moving way. You know, it takes time for people to make a decision to buy a house and get financing and purchase it. And the same thing happens on the other side. It takes a long time for people to finally decide they just can't make the payments anymore and they have to sell and put it on the market and then see that's not selling and drop the price and still not selling and then it gets foreclosed.
Right.
So this isn't the sort of thing that works its way through. If it gets into that point, it's not something that works its way through in weeks or months.
Right. It's a little bit longer than that. Yeah.
Right. It can be longer than that. And in fact, it could end up being a lot longer than that if things extend out to where, you know, the baby boomers enter into the equation. I mean,
right.
Housing prices in the late 70s doubled in a few years because all the baby boomers were at the house-buying age. The same thing could happen in reverse is the baby boomers start to retire and are trying to sell their houses to use, you know, the money locked into their houses for retirement. So if you see that cycle added to the current potential cycle, you know, things could look pretty bleak for housing, and that could feed into the rest of the economy.
So you're probably a watcher, or you look at a good friend of mine, Harry Dent, who, as a matter of fact, Harry Dent, Demographic Economics, he was on the podcast last week, you follow any of his work?
No, I've heard his name, but I haven't.
You need to pick that up because there's a great couple of good books on overlays on that whole issue of the baby boomers, the money spending, and his prediction for the 2009-2010 just absolute crash of our markets. Really fascinating work.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that's interesting with demographics is that, in a sense, you can see it coming because you know the demographic cycles, but it's so slow moving that people don't think much about it. But, you know, you go back even to, you know, the 50s and 60s when elementary schools were being built right and left.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can follow all these events in our economy that are due to sort of the passage of this tidal wave of the baby boomers. And although I haven't, you know, read his books, I don't know his specific conclusions, you know, the next step, I think, is the baby boomers selling their houses for retirement and starting to dissave, that is starting to sell the stocks that they've been accumulating over the last 20 years or
exactly,
so.
Exactly. All right, well, let's end on that. And I guess tell everybody where they can to find you.
Okay. Of course, my book, A Demon of Our Own Design, is available in bookstores or through Amazon.com. And I also have a blog related to my book, rick.bookstaber.com. That, you know, I put observations that are related to the book, and when people ask questions when I'm giving talks and so on, I include them in there. So people may find that interesting.
And I'll put a link on that on this on the show notes for this podcast. Thanks so much for coming along and telling us very interesting stuff. I appreciate it.
Thanks. It's nice talking with you.
All right, so that about wraps it up for today's episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and episode 33 is in the bag, as they say. You want to make sure, you want to make sure to stay tuned for episode 34 because we're having a big debut and a big premiere on the Microsoft Zune Marketplace. And with that, we have Jim Jubak. Look him up, J-U-B-A-K. He's an amazing guy. Look at his portfolio. You got to see the numbers we're talking about. He's the senior editor and the writer for Money Central, one of my favorite sites. So with that in mind, we're going to wrap it up today. Make sure you get your copy again. It's the last week of the Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success at $14.95, and the signed edition for the first 100. And with that, I say, have a great week. Be careful, be smart, get ahead of the pros because you deserve it. You're going to make a lot of money. I'll see you real soon. Andrew Horowitz, signing off.
The The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.